companies in France, such as the pharmaceutical Sanofi, car constructors Renault and PSA, and Airbus also benefit from important tax reductions and financial aid from the government, but that does not prevent them to fire workers.
Sanofi receives about 120 million euros every year for research. They pay less taxes and they are going to pay 4 billion euros to their shareholders. Today they announced a record of their profits. Meanwhile, they are firing workers and they did not find a vaccine. There is a problem.
France has not been able to produce its own vaccine, unlike the USA, Russia, China, and even Cuba. A big disappointment for French people. Experts say it's due to the continuous privatization. Scientific research has been sacrificed for short-term profits.
We can't continue with the pharmaceutical industry that's making a huge amount of profit without investing their benefits in research for the general interest. Public research has to be maintained. The fact that Sanofi has not been able to produce a vaccine reveals a real problem in the system.
According to the National Institute for Economic Studies, INSEE, the French gross domestic product, GDP, went down with more than 8% in 2020. Less than expected, but still a record since the Second World War. Unemployment increased with 8%. Nevertheless, the main French companies are making more profits today than before the COVID crisis. Profits for few, sacrifices for many.
It's difficult to organize workers during lockdowns and curfews. Fundamental liberties are put in danger with the COVID crisis. A united front, as shown today in France, is one of the means to go forward. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Senior leaders of combined opposition parties, including Pakistan People's Party and Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, gathered in Islamabad to decide new course of action after opposition's deadline to Prime Minister Imran Khan to resign expired. After hours-long meeting, they announced that people from all over Pakistan would start a mass long march towards the capital Islamabad on March 26 this year to force the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to step down and hold fresh general elections. The opposition blames the military to have rigged general elections in favor of Prime Minister Imran Khan in 2018.
We are struggling to get rid of an illegitimate government which was formed through rigging in general elections. We are trying to restore the sanctity of the public mandate.
A better sense must prevail among the opposition parties. The opposition must understand that their protests would not bring down our government. When we were in the opposition, we held protest rallies in Islamabad for 126 days to bring down the government.
The opposition launched a public mobilization campaign late last year across Pakistan to prepare people for the long march next month, something which government believes received a lackluster response. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that the opposition parties turned against him after he rejected their backdoor request to stop prosecuting top opposition leaders on corruption charges. The opposition's decision to start a mass long march has come after anti-graft watchdog started prosecuting top opposition leaders on money laundering charges. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has already been convicted on money laundering charges.
Analysts believe that the opposition parties enjoy little public support after their top leaders were tainted with the corruption charges. However, discontentment prevails among people over unprecedented price hike after Pakistan devalued its currency under IMF pressure, something opposition failed to exploit in its favor. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
February 4th is World Cancer Day, and on this day, thousands of Gazan cancer patients suffer immensely due to the crippling Israeli blockade. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before being able to receive treatment. Gaza hospitals suffer from acute shortage of medicines, especially for cancer patients. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished enclave can be a stressful and unpredictable process, and many apply multiple times before being able to exit.
Israel usually doesn't allow Palestinian patients to travel through the Erez crossing despite having an exit permit. They only need to leave the Gaza Strip to receive required treatments.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment with a 50% deficit rate. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime also refuses to allow spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza.
Radiation therapy, especially for breast cancer patients, is not available in the Gaza Strip, and patients must go to hospitals in Israel or the occupied West Bank for treatment. Radiation therapy is a hard process and takes a very long time to get an Israeli permit for such procedures. Oftentimes, cancer patients miss their hospital appointments due to delayed exit permits.
There are around 14,000 cancer patients in the Gaza Strip, 47% male and 53% female. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among females. Cancer patients have also complained of humiliating treatment at the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing.
The process in the Israeli crossing is extremely humiliating because they insist on strip searching you. I was very sick and they kept interrogating me for 3 hours and then they began to strip search me. I told them that I had a mastectomy, but the Israelis did not let me go through until they did a full body search.
Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to further deteriorate.
Human rights organizations in the Gaza Strip have repeatedly urged the international community to help bring an end to the Israeli blockade and save the lives of cancer patients. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability, insecurity, and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaydah, Al-Dala, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and the children. 2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis, as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that it is willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal from which former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally exited in 2018 and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. But 2 weeks after taking the helm at the White House, Washington's return to the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still hangs in the balance. The U.S. says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord, but Tehran says it was Washington that walked away and hence it should fulfill all its obligations, which include the lifting of all sanctions. Amid the standoff, Iran's foreign minister warned that the Biden administration has a limited window of opportunity to re-enter the agreement. He, meanwhile, suggested the question over who must take the first step in returning to the JCPOA could be resolved by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
In reaction, the European Union said it is working extremely hard to salvage the deal and is in talks with the U.S. administration to see if sanctions could be lifted. And this is how the U.S. reacted to Zarif's suggestion.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same. And then we would then use that as a platform to build a longer and a stronger agreement that also addresses other areas of concern.
Such a stance was earlier echoed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is in line with Washington's policy to expand the JCPOA beyond Iran's nuclear issue. French President Emmanuel Macron has also said Saudi Arabia should be involved in any new negotiations with Iran about the deal. But Iran's president has reiterated that the JCPOA remains unchanged.
I clearly tell the global community, and especially the countries in the JCPOA, whether it's 4+1 or maybe 5+1 in the future, that no clause of the JCPOA will change. Know this. And no one will be added to it.
After the U.S. pullout of the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, the EU, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Iran says its measures are fully reversible upon the full compliance by the remaining signatories. Presently, questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or will try to rectify the Trump-era policy, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's close allies.
Italy's President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, gave Mario Draghi a mandate to attempt to form a new government after efforts to salvage the coalition supporting outgoing Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte had failed. Draghi, 73 years of age, had largely vanished from public view since his mandate as President of the European Central Bank ended after 8 years in 2019. His name emerged as a potential prime minister when the government crisis sparked in Italy in mid-January. The crisis had been triggered by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, whose unexpected decision to withdraw his small party's support to the previous executive had forced Conte to resign.
Con questa speranza,
I am confident that the unity and the capacity to give a responsible response will emerge from the discussion with the parties, with the groups in Parliament. The challenges are to defeat the pandemic, complete the vaccination campaign, offer responses to everyday problems, and relaunch the country using the extraordinary resources from the EU.
The country desperately needs to secure an immediate massive injection of liquidity into its staggering economy. Italy has reported its biggest contraction in GDP since the end of World War II following the pandemic. The National Bureau of Statistics estimates the country's economy shrank by almost 9% last year.
What is there to understand is if the next government will be technical or political. This is for Prime Minister-designate Draghi to find out. Draghi unusually met with outgoing Prime Minister Conte after receiving the mandate to see if he can also count on his support.
It cannot be taken for granted that a Draghi executive would win substantial backing from parties across the political spectrum. Many five-star movement lawmakers have said they will not vote in favor of a technocrat government led by Draghi, arguing the only possible executive must be a political one.
Also, nationalist Brothers of Italy leader Giorgia Meloni warned her party would not support Draghi as prime minister, calling her lies. The anti-immigrant, anti-EU League party of Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right Forza Italia party to abstain any vote for him. Max Civili, Rome.
Russia's Sputnik V vaccine is more than 91% effective against COVID-19. The news was published Tuesday in The Lancet, a British medical journal. This is great news for all the countries already administering the vaccine and all those looking for alternative supplies.
It's unconditionally an epoch-making event. There are four vaccines in the world which published what's called the third phase of trials. Our vaccine is among the three most effective vaccines in the world.
After the announcement, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said every vaccine is welcome in the European Union. The bloc's vaccine rollout is lagging behind the UK and the US, and desperate and disappointed member states, including Hungary, are looking elsewhere for supplies.
The centralized vaccine procurement of Brussels has failed. This is risking the lives of Europeans and the quick relaunching of the European economy. That's why we have looked for new sources of supply. We were the first, but it is unlikely that we will be the only ones in the European Union in this effort.
Armenia, Belarus, and Serbia have already got Sputnik V. European countries which are not EU members and say they were losing out waiting for the COVAX program, which was supposed to make vaccines available to everyone, to deliver. Countries hard hit by Western sanctions have also approved Sputnik V. Venezuela has already received its first shipment, and Iran's first batch is expected any day now. Russia has donated 5,000 doses to the Palestinians in the occupied territories as well. The World Health Organization says to end the COVID-19 pandemic, it has to be ended for everyone, everywhere. Nonetheless, rich countries are hoarding and rolling out vaccines, while the least developed nations watch and wait. It may take years for the poorest to get the jab. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That's the precise number of refugees currently barely surviving in awful conditions on the islands of Greece, apparently a proud member of the 27-nation EU. Legislators have been discussing the situation here in the European Parliament, Brussels.
Most of the time, people are locked up in the camps. Does the Commission think this is imprisonment? And if not, what is the difference between this and imprisonment?
There are not enough toilets or hot showers in the overcrowded camps. EU lawmakers say this is all the more appalling against the backdrop of a global pandemic.
Tents have been set up in October, and only in January they start winterization, as if the arrival of winter was a big surprise. And they're tents, it's very basic.
The Parliament debate heard that 60% of the refugees have reported suicidal thoughts to doctors. On Lesbos alone, there are 129 babies under the age of one. EU nations pledged to take in 5,145 refugees from the islands, but just half that number have been relocated.
There are many people who have now been granted international protection who are still stuck in the camps. What's going to happen with them? Do we have commitment by other member states to take over people, and why is this not happening?
The argument has been made the EU has a special responsibility in this regard because of the very destabilizing roles some of the bloc's countries have played in Africa and in the Middle East.
The shape of the current political landscape in the EU does not inject confidence that the bloc's asylum policy will change anytime soon, according to experts.
There is across Europe now this sense that of xenophobia, of populism, a resistance to seeing more migration. So it makes it very, very tough to do.
Lawmakers say EU governments are using the pandemic as a reason to extricate themselves from their fundamental human rights responsibilities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the war. In his first foreign policy speeches, President Biden said this war has to end, and to underscore the U.S.'s commitment, Washington would end all relevant arms sales to the Saudis. In reaction to the U.S. president's decision, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said that Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. The announcement also puts the spotlight on a major humanitarian crisis that the U.S. helped aggravate. The reversing of the policy also comes as a rebuke to Saudi Arabia, a major U.S. ally in the Persian Gulf region. The war, which has been accompanied by an all-out siege of the impoverished Arab country, has resulted in the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to reinstate former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi and suppress the Ansar Allah movement, who took control of the country after Hadi's resignation. The Saudi-led coalition expected to finish its job in weeks, but it has been nearly 6 years. Riyadh and its allies are stuck in this quagmire. Since day one, the United States and some European countries have been supporting this war either by selling arms to the aggressors or by taking no action toward the crimes being committed against the Yemeni people. Washington also blacklisted the Ansar Allah movement and their supporters while they are defending their country against the aggression. Now the new U.S. administration apparently wants to have a different approach toward the war. In his first foreign policy speech on Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden called for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe. I've asked my Middle East team to ensure our support for the United Nations-led initiative to impose a ceasefire, open humanitarian challenge, and restore long dormant peace talks.
Biden said he will end all American support for offensive operations in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. He added that his administration will push for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Yemen and will make sure humanitarian aid reaches the Yemeni people. Nonetheless, the U.S. president also pledges support for Saudi Arabia to defend its sovereignty. Biden's remarks drew reaction from Yemen's Ansar Allah movement. An Ansar Allah spokesman said the only way to restore peace in Yemen is to stop the Saudi-led war and end the blockade. A senior Ansar Allah official also noted that any action without tangible results to end the war will be futile.
I think that Biden has realized that the Saudi war on Yemen, like the Saudi war on Syria, has failed. And what might happen is that the Saudi regime, the monarchy, collapses. And that would be a disaster for the U.S. because it's one of the pillars of their domination of the Middle East. It's one of their main client states in the Middle East besides Israel.
According to the United Nations, the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused the world's biggest humanitarian catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed, while millions displaced since the war started in March 2015. Now that the new U.S. administration wants to show its goodwill and different policy from the previous one, the first step to end the war will be taking Ansar Allah off Washington's so-called terror list. The world has to wait and watch how serious Biden is in his pledge of ending the war on Yemen and bringing peace to the impoverished Arab country.
Joining us on this debate, we have author of No More War, Mr. Daniel Kovalik, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also from New York, we have author and activist Sarah Flounders. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Kovalik in Pittsburgh. U.S. President Joe Biden announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the country's war. Will he act on those comments? For example, will he actually sign the bill, the same bipartisan bill that the Senate tried to get past Donald Trump?
Well, all of that remains to be seen. First of all, obviously, those of us who care about peace, who care about human rights, welcome Biden's statement that he's going to end support of Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen. We've been pushing the U.S. to end its support for the Saudi war for some time. At the same time, the fact that he says, uses words like offensive operations, while saying that he's going to still help Saudi Arabia with its defense and still help Saudi Arabia allegedly go after Al-Qaeda in Yemen, when in fact Saudi Arabia has been partnering with Al-Qaeda in Yemen, makes me wonder what the policy really is. I just think we don't know. Right now, he's, you know, put loopholes in big enough for a Mack truck to drive through. So I think the situation has to be monitored very, very seriously.
Sarah Flounders, the U.S. president said in a speech at the State Department that the war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Is that enough, though, ending offensive support? Isn't it about time, in your opinion, for maybe a less hawkish U.S. foreign policy, one with less bombs and more aid and actual diplomacy?
Certainly, this is absolutely true, because it's semantics to say, well, we're going to end some offensive aid, and yet we're going to keep defending Saudi Arabia, really means that there's a back door in this that you could drive a truck through. If there's any sincerity, the first step is to absolutely end the U.S. Foreign terrorist organization label that they've put on the Ansarullah movement, on the Houthi movement, to immediately end the siege, to end the sanctions, to allow immediate aid to arrive in Yemen. Those are the first steps. And just a general statement that the U.S. will now set up a negotiation, we saw where that led in Syria. They've supposedly been negotiating while being actively involved now for many years, and the sanctions have continued and the efforts to stop rebuilding. So what does it mean in Yemen? I think we should use it as an opportunity to really demand that there be real life to this. What the U.S. has found is that they were unable, despite years of bombing, and this was really a U.S. war. It was never Saudi Arabia alone. It couldn't have lasted one day without U.S. technicians, U.S. aircraft, U.S. bombs, equipment, satellite reconnaissance, U.S. Navy blockade. All of this was a U.S. war. Will it really end? That's the question. And will Yemen have a chance to breathe a sigh of relief? Clearly, it didn't succeed. And a people's movement in Yemen has been able to survive and continue a resistance. And we should really salute that struggle and that determination, that resistance, because it shows that it's possible, even against massive bombardment of school buses and schools and hospitals and marketplaces and wedding parties. We should just think of the crimes of the past years.
Daniel Kovalik, that's an interesting point our guest in New York just brought up. If Biden is serious, here's a first step. Reverse the designation of Ansarullah as a terrorist organization. The UN and aid groups have called the designation to be reversed numerous times, warning that it would push Yemen into a large-scale famine and it would seriously impede humanitarian activities in Yemen. Do you think he'll reverse it?
Well, first of all, I agree that that has to be done immediately. I'm concerned that he has not done it yet. That would not take anything but for the State Department to reverse that. It can be done by fiat. You know, we don't need people to vote on it. Why hasn't he done it yet? So I don't know if he's going to do it, but I agree it has to be done, because once you declare – they've essentially declared the government of Yemen a terrorist organization. And what that means, under binding Security Council resolutions, countries cannot trade with Yemen. They cannot do banking with Yemen. And so, as you know, the UN has raised the alarm that that designation will only deepen the worst humanitarian crisis the world has known since World War II.
Sarah Flounders, reacting to the news of the U.S. president's comments, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said the Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. In other words, they want to see action. Why should they trust Washington? In fact, back in 2015, it was the Obama administration, along with Vice President Joe Biden, that gave Riyadh the support to carry out this war in the first place, as you mentioned also.
Well, it is heartening, their statement, that they will not be fooled, because it means that they really understand deeply from the beginning this was a U.S. war. They know who they're up against. They have clear demands for how to end the siege and how to have legitimate negotiations, if that's what's on called for. But they also see through the Biden administration. There is a new cabinet, but they all, every single one of the people that Biden has named, are really war criminals in their threats against Iran for many years, and their war in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Syria and in Libya and Yemen. So we shouldn't give any credence to Biden or Blinken in terms of the State Department. I think we need to continue real support for a people's movement and struggle in Yemen, and also show confidence they know who they're dealing with. So I thought that the response today, from the Supreme Military Council and from senior officials shows that they, as a political force, know who they're dealing with and are preparing next steps ahead. So it's a difficult time, because this will be used internationally. Biden is trying to position himself in a new way to continue war in the region.
Daniel Kovalik, should the Yemenis trust the United States?
No, of course not. I mean, the U.S. has, look at Vietnam was a famous case where, of course, at every moment we were about to win and pull out of Vietnam, when in fact it went on for many years. Same thing in Afghanistan, right? We're now 20 years into that war. Trump was actually trying to withdraw troops. It's clear that now Biden is going to stop that withdrawal. The U.S. cannot be trusted on this. I will say, though, that, one thing that gives me pause is whether, in fact, Biden does want to end some of the conflicts in the Middle East, because he has his sights on bigger game. For example, the very influential Atlantic Council just released a white paper urging Biden to engage in regime change in China. China clearly being a target of the Biden administration, and possibly Russia. So I agree with my colleague that, whatever the result for Yemen, and obviously we want to see peace in Yemen, I think we have to be vigilant to see what Biden is going to do also in the rest of the world.
Ms. Founders, here's another perspective. Skeptics are saying that Biden is basically just sweet-talking right now, that he's an old wolf of U.S. foreign policy, and he isn't going to let down the U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Middle East that they've armed and supported for so long. Do you see it in that light as well?
I very much do. He is an old wolf, an old war criminal. Let's really say who he is. The staunchest supporter of the U.S. war in Iraq, in Syria, in Afghanistan, and Yemen. And even Blinken in the confirmation hearing said, we have to relook at sanctions so they give the greatest pain. Those are his words. A conscious understanding. These are really criminal forces within U.S. policy. But I do so much agree with Dan. They are trying to reposition themselves on how they can really focus attention on China, on Russia, on Iran. And so can they reposition themselves with forces here in the U.S. to disarm the movement here? Can they reposition themselves with European forces, EU, and some of the NATO forces? Can they put a new look on their wars? That's what they're attempting to do. And at the same time, they are going full steam ahead to make new threats on the world. It's a very dangerous time, because clearly the U.S. Economic position, is weakening, and their ability to impose their will on the world has been severely challenged. But again, we should really applaud the struggle in Yemen for surviving these difficult years and as a cohesive force with an understanding of what they're up against.
Danny Kovalik, let's get your thoughts on the matter as well. Do you think that Joe Biden, he's not one to let the likes of the Saudis down, is he?
No, of course not, and he's made that clear. He made it clear publicly, and he also talked to the Saudis before making this announcement, making it clear that the announcement was not going to affect U.S.-Saudi relationships. So clearly, Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, continue, it looks like, Trump's policies towards Israel. We just saw that the Senate, for example, unanimously approved to continue the U.S.'s embassy to Israel in Jerusalem, for example. I think he will continue those policies. I think what you're going to see is, you know, at least on its face, a kinder, gentler leader of imperialism. But that does not mean it's any less aggressive or cruel. In fact, Intercept recently reminded us that the CIA, in an internal document, thought Obama was the best leader for the United States because, you know, the world and Americans interested in peace trusted him. And so he was able to get away with things, including the war in Libya, that other presidents could not. And I think Biden will do the same. I mean, the irony of Trump is that while he was coarse and he was poorly spoken and he was openly racist, which are all bad things, he showed the true face of American imperialism. And that was actually a good thing. And I think the world woke up a bit, and Biden is hoping the world's going to go back to sleep.
Sarah Flounders, the reversing of this policy, it definitely is a rebuke to Saudi Arabia, which has been a long time a U.S. Strategic ally. If Biden's position or the U.S.'s position isn't going to change too much with regards to Riyadh, then what kind of message is this sending to the Saudis?
Well, it's really sending them a message that there's going to be some new positioning, but there's no pullback in military assistance or in diplomatic political support. So the message is, you know, we're changing the game a bit. Don't worry too much. The U.S. well knows how to drag negotiations on for years and make demand after demand on the forces that they're negotiating with. Clearly, they want to demand and try to divide the movement in Yemen. That's their first goal in opening negotiations, who they speak to, who they're speaking to on one ear and then the other. They, of course, want to weaken and undermine the position of Iran in the region. And so there's a lot that Saudi Arabia is a real pillar, absolutely, of U.S. Domination and control in the region, but it is a pillar, you know, based on sand. It's a completely corrupt regime held in the hands of one family with seething discontent below. So, you know, they may be looking for ways even to shore up and get Saudi Arabia out of a very difficult position by more actively engaging in negotiations and not just sitting next to them at the bomb control missions, which is what they've been doing, not just servicing the planes militarily, but intervening more politically with the regime. So, but that's not an effort of liberation at all. It's not an effort at human rights for anyone in the region ever.
Daniel, let's hit rewind here for a second. On the campaign trail for the presidency, Joe Biden said that he would punish Saudi leaders for Jamal Khashoggi's murder, adding that he believed the order was given by the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. He said, and I quote, We will, in fact, make them the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen. I'd like to get your thoughts on those comments made by Joe Biden. Should Riyadh start to worry a little bit if Biden is to keep his election campaign promises?
First of all, I would agree that Riyadh should be punished for these things, particularly the war in Yemen, which is, in my belief, a genocidal war, which has already destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives, destroyed countless UNESCO historic sites. But I don't believe that Biden will do that. I think it's clear he won't. I think if he was going to do that, he would have signaled it. I think that is clearly a promise he is going to back off of.
And Ms. Flounders, your thoughts on that issue as well. We've got probably less than 30 seconds to get your final thoughts.
Yeah, I very much agree. Biden said a lot of things during his campaign, and so far he's falling short on every single one of them. You know, politicians make campaign promises, and then there's a reality of the institution that they represent, which is U.S. imperialism. They want to continue that domination, and at great cost to the people of the world and the people right here at home. So I wouldn't trust one promise.
Thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guests. Author of No More War, Daniel Cavallo, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also thanks to author and activist Sarah Flounders speaking to us from New York. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Women, pioneers of the Islamic Revolution. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the seventh day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. Whenever the goals and ideals of the Islamic Revolution are exposed to threats, women enter the scene of struggles alongside men and prove that the Iranian woman firmly sticks to her covenant with the revolution and the ideals of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei. Women have proved their potentials in various fields beside men. For the past year that coronavirus has spread all over the world, Iranian women have proven their self-sacrifice by rushing to take care and cure patients. Some of them have even delayed their marriage to help the patients. One of the outstanding scenes of selfless efforts was that Fatemeh Mukhbir, daughter of the headquarters for execution of Imam Khomeini's order, volunteered for getting coronavirus jabs. One of the honorable scenes of self-sacrifice and patience was shown by the wife of the prominent nuclear scientist, martyr Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who said that she would continue the path of her husband, although she had been alongside her husband and seen his assassination. Let us move 1 year back. Last year, the U.S. Terrorist Army, upon the direct order of the former President Donald Trump, targeted the champion of fight against terrorism, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and killed him, and the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, together with eight of their companions near Baghdad airport. The Americans thought that the move could stop the movement of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance axis, but Martyr Soleimani's daughters Fatima and Zainab stood firmly and announced that they would continue their father's path. Moreover, Zainab took the responsibility of the foundation of Martyr Soleimani's school. Women have undoubtedly played a very important role in the course of the Islamic Revolution. They have shown the culmination of awareness, commitment, steadfastness, and loyalty. These women have participated in cultural, social, political, educational, and economic scenes to help advance the Islamic Revolution. The founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, explained the role of women in the first month after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In early March 1979, he said, "You women prove that you are in the forefront. You prove that you are ahead of men. Men are inspired by you. Iran's men have been admonished by women and learned lessons from them." The historic role of men and women in defense of their religion and land is originated in the Islamic culture. Although women have been excluded from armed battle in Islam, they can take part in other aspects of struggle. As a matter of fact, the role of women behind the battlefront cannot be ignored. During the eight-year imposed war, too, women participated in various fields to support the combatants. Many of them worked as doctors and nurses, and hundreds of thousands of them were active in cities in logistics and preparations for the fronts. This took place in the era of Prophet of Islam too. Women like Nasibe and Atiye participated in many of the battles as nurses and assistants. All Muslim ladies have learned these lessons of self-sacrifice from Lady Khadija, Lady Fatima, and Lady Zainab, who spent their life to support Islamic values and ideals. Furthermore, they encouraged their men to go to the war theaters. Imam Khomeini said on these women, "This is the light of faith that you ladies are not scared of martyrdom. Our youths and our men and women are ready for martyrdom. Women are builders of human beings. That's why the domineering system has tried its utmost to deprive them of this role through myriads of stratagems. This system has tried to plunge women in sexuality and corruption through exposure of their beauties to paralyze nations." Contrary to the corrupt wishes of the domineering system led by the U.S., the mothers of martyrs have tried to immortalize their martyrs through keeping the love of God alive among masses. As soon as they heard the news of martyrdom of their sons, they would thank God and appeal to God to accept their sacrifice. Many of these mothers buried their sons themselves. The presence of Muslim ladies in various scenes of the Islamic Revolution has taught the women of other nations and dumbfounded the ill-wishers. A French female reporter wrote in her memoirs of the first year of the revolution, "In Iran, everyone is striving within a great socio-political development to build the structure of an Islamic government. Meanwhile, what is notable more than anything else is the steadfastness and inexhaustibility of women alongside men."
Good morning.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.